the race of men at your beck and call. Who would dare disobey your smallest wish? Who would not tremble in fear of your displeasure? Promise me my life, Master Beekeeper, and I shall promise you.
Do you bargain with enchantment you stole and corrupted? Tyran cried angrily. Let its secrets die with you. At this, Morda howled horribly and pressed himself almost flat on the ground. Barking sobs racked his body.
My life! Spare it! Spare it! Do not give me to death! Take the gem! Change me to the lowest crawling thing, to foulest vermin! Only let me live!
The sight of the cowering wizard turned Tyran sick at heart, and for a long moment he could not speak. At last he said, I will not kill you, Morda. The wizard left off his frightful sobbing and lifted his head.
You will not, Master Pigkeeper?
He crept forward and made as though to fling his arms about Tyran's feet. I will not kill you, repeated Tyran, drawing back in revulsion, though it is in my heart to do so. Your evil is too deep for me to judge your punishment. Restore my companions, he commanded. Then you will go prisoner with me to Dalban. He alone can give you whatever justice you may hope for. Stand, wizard, cast Angerad's jewel from you. Morda, still crouching, slowly and reluctantly pulled the chain from his wrist. His pasty cheeks trembled as he fondled the winking gem, murmuring and muttering to himself. Suddenly he leapt upright and sprang forward. With all his might, he swung the jewel at the end of its chain like a whip across Tyran's face. The sharp edges of the stone slashed Tyran's forehead. With a cry, he stumbled backward. Blood streamed into his eyes, blinding him. The shard of bone flew from his fingers and went spinning and skittering over the floor. Under the force of the wizard's blow, the jewel snapped from its silver chain and rolled into a corner. In another moment, the wizard was upon him, growling and snarling like a mad beast. Morda's fingers clawed at Tyran's throat. His yellow teeth were bared in a ghastly grin. Tyran strove to tear himself from the wizard's grasp, but the frenzy of Morda's attack staggered him. He lost his footing and tumbled to earth. Uselessly, he sought to break the deadly grip that stifled him. His head whirled. Through blood-filled eyes, he glimpsed the wizard's face, twisted in hate and fury.
Your strength will not save you, Morda hissed. It is no match for mine. You are weak, as all your kind. Did I not warn you? My life is not in my body. Strong as death am I. So shall you die, Pigkeeper.
With sudden horror, Tyran knew the wizard spoke the truth. Morda's wasted arms were hard as gnarled branches, and though Tyran struggled desperately, the wizard's relentless grip tightened. Tyran's lungs heaved to bursting, and he felt himself drowning in a black sea. Morda's features blurred, only the wizard's baleful, unlidded gaze stayed fixed. A crash of splintering wood shattered in Tyran's ears. Morda's grip suddenly slackened. Shouting in alarm and rage, the wizard leapt to his feet and spun about. His head still reeling, Tyran clutched at the wall and tried to draw himself up. Lian had burst into the chamber. Growling fiercely, her eyes blazing gold fires, the huge cat sprang forward. Morda turned to meet her attack. Lian, beware of him, Tyran cried. The force of Lian's charge bore the wizard to his knees, but Morda, in his unyielding strength, grappled with the animal. Lian flung her tawny body right and left, her powerful hind legs, their claws unsheathed, lashed vainly at the wizard, who twisted from her paws and now clung to her arching back. Yowling and spitting, the great cat tossed her head furiously, her sharp teeth flashed in her massive jaws. Yet, with all her might, she could not free herself from the wizard's clutches. Tyran knew even Lian's strength would soon ebb, just as his own had failed. She had given him a moment more of life, but now Lian herself was doomed. The bone! Tyran dropped to hands and knees, seeking the shard. Nowhere did he see it. He flung aside wooden stools, upturned earthen vessels, scrabbled in the ashes of the hearth. The bone had vanished. From behind him rose a high twittering and squeaking, and he spun to see the mouse bobbing frantically on its hind legs. In its jaws, the creature held the splinter of bone. Instantly, Taran caught up the polished fragment to snap it between his fingers. He gasped in dismay. The bone would not break. Chapter 10. The Broken Spell. The polished splinter was unyielding as iron. Teeth clenched and muscles trembling with his effort, Taran felt he struggled against the wizard himself. Lian had dropped weakly to her haunches. Morda sprang free of the unconscious cat and set upon Taran once more, snatching at the fragment. The wizard's fingers locked on the middle of the shard, but Taran clung with all his strength to the ends of it. He felt the splinter bend as Morda strove to wrest it from his grasp. Suddenly, the bone snapped in two. A sound sharper than a thunderclap split Taran's ears. With a horrible scream that stabbed through the chamber, Morda toppled backward, stiffened, clawed the air, then fell to the ground like a pile of broken twigs. That same instant, the mouse vanished. Gurgi stood at Taran's side.
"Coin Master saves us,"
he yelled, flinging his arms about Taran.
"Yes, yes, Gurgi is Gurgi again. No more a mouse with shriekings and squeakings."
In Taran's hand, the sundered bone had turned to grey dust, which he cast aside. Too exhausted and bewildered to speak, he could only pat Gurgi fondly and gratefully. Lian, her deep chest heaving, climbed to her feet near Morda's broken, lifeless form. Her tawny fur still bristled furiously, and her long tail looked twice its thickness. As Gurgi hastened to unloose Kor, who jabbered at the top of his voice and beat his wings excitedly against the cage, Lian's golden eyes darted about the chamber, and from her throat rose an anxious, questioning trill.
"Great Belin,"
came Fluda's voice.
"I'm trapped as badly as before."
Lian loping ahead of him, Taran ran to a corner of the chamber. The basket in which Morda imprisoned the hare now held the bard, squeezed into it along with his harp, and stuck fast with his long shanks dangling over one side and his arms flapping helplessly over the other. With some difficulty, Taran and Gurgi set about freeing the bard, who hardly left off stammering incoherently all the while. Fluda's face was ashen from fright. He blinked, shook his ragged yellow head, and heaved huge sighs of relief.
"What humiliation!"
he burst out.
"A flam turned into a rabbit. I felt I'd been stuffed in a woolsack. Great Belin, my nose still twitches. Never again. I told you no good comes from meddling. Though in this case, Taran, old friend, it's lucky you had that bone. Ah, easy there. That wicker's jabbing me. A rabbit, indeed. If I could only have got my paws, I mean hands, on that foul Morda."
At last, out of the basket, Fluda threw his arms around Lian's powerful neck.
"And you, old girl, if you hadn't come looking for us..."
He shuddered and clapped hands to his ears.
"Yes, well, let's not think of that."
In the doorway stood a short, stocky, stoutly booted figure dressed in russet leather, on his head a round, close-fitting leather cap. Thumbs hooked into his belt, he turned bright crimson eyes on each of the companions. Instead of his customary scowl, a grin stretched across his broad face.
"Dolly!" Taran cried, first catching sight of the dwarf. "It's you again!"
"Again?"
snapped Dolly, trying to make his voice as gruff as he could.
"It always was."
He strode into the chamber. For a moment, he looked down at Morda and nodded curtly.
"So that's the way of it," he said to Taran. "I thought as much. One moment I was a frog, wrapped in a sopping wet cloak. Sure all of you had been slain, and the next, as you see me." "That cat of yours grew restless after a time," Dolly went on, turning to Fluda. "She picked me up, cloak and all, and went off on your trail."
"She won't let me out of her sight," replied Fluda. for which,
he added, fondly rubbing Leanne's ears, we've all to thank her. But how did she get through the thorns? Taran asked. Morda's traps.
Through?
Answered Dolly.
She didn't go through. She went over.
He shook his head.
In one bound, with me in her mouth. I've never seen a creature jump so high. On the other hand, I've never seen a creature like this. But what of the rest of you? What of Morda?
If you don't mind,
Fluda interrupted before Taran could finish telling the dwarf of their ordeal,
I suggest leaving here immediately. A flam is steadfast, but there's something about enchantments, even broken ones, that tends to, disturb me.
Wait, cried Taran. The jewel, where is it? As Dolly watched, puzzled, the companions hastily set about searching every corner of the chamber, to no avail. Taran's concern mounted, for he was reluctant to leave the gem unfound. However, when almost ready to admit the jewel was hopelessly lost, he heard a raucous laugh above his head. Cor, perched on an oaken rafter, rocked back and forth, chuckling and squawking, delighted with himself. The jewel glittered in his beak.
"Hi, hi!" shouted Fluda, alarmed. "Give it up! Great Belin, you'll have us all paws and tails again!"
After much coaxing by Taran and indignant retorts by the bard, Cor flapped to Taran's shoulder and dropped the gem in his hand.
"Now it belongs to wise and kindly master,"
Gurgi exclaimed.
"Gurgi fears stone of winkings and blinkings, but not when kindly master holds it."
Dolly peered at the gem as Taran held it up.
So that's how Morda meant to enslave us. I should have guessed. This comes from the Fairfolk realm, he added. We always honored the House of Lear and gave the stone to Princess Rigat as our wedding gift. She must have handed it down to her daughter. And when Angerad vanished, the jewel vanished with her.
And now it comes to my hands, Taran said. He cupped the gem in his palm, watching the play of light in the depths of the crystal. Morda has turned a thing of usefulness and beauty to evil ends. Whether it may ever serve its true purpose again, I do not know. To speak truth, it draws me, and frightens me too. Its power is vast, too vast perhaps for any man to hold. Even if I could learn its secrets, I would not choose to do so. He smiled at Gurgi. Do you call me wise? At least I'm wise enough to know I'll never have wisdom enough to use it. Still, it may serve one purpose, Taran went on. With this to bargain, Ordu will surely tell me who I am. Yes, he cried. This is a treasure she won't refuse. He stopped abruptly and paused a long moment. In his grasp lay means to gain the knowledge he craved. But his heart sank. Though he had won the gem fairly, never could he claim to be its rightful owner. It was his to bargain with no more than it had been Morda's. If Ordu accepted it, and if he should learn he was of noble birth, was a royal robe enough to hide a dishonorable deed? He looked at Dolly. The gem is mine, Taran said, but only mine to give, not mine to keep. Slowly he pressed the jewel into Dolly's hand. Take this. It belonged once to the fair folk. It belongs to them once more. The dwarf's usual scowl softened.
You've done us a service, he answered. Very likely, the greatest service any of you mortals have done for the fair folk. Without your help, Morda could have destroyed us all. Yes, the gem must return to our realm. It's too dangerous in other hands. You chose well. King Idileg will ever remember you for this. You have his thanks, and mine.
Dolly nodded with satisfaction, and tucked the stone carefully into his jacket.
It's made a long journey. Alas, it comes back to us. Yes, yes, shouted Gurgi. Take it for keepings. If kindly master will not have it, then Gurgi wants to see no more of wicked stone. Away with it, away! Do not let it turn faithful Gurgi into a mouse again.
Taran, with a fond laugh, put a hand on Gurgi's shoulder. Morda couldn't have changed what you truly are, any more than he could have changed Dolly. Mouse though you might have seemed, you still had the heart of a lion. But what of me? He murmured thoughtfully. As a caged eagle, as a blind worm, could I indeed have stayed myself? Would I still have been Taran, when I scarcely know who Taran is? The sun had begun to climb, promising a day blue and fresh when the companions left the wizard's fastness. The wall of thorns had fallen, shattered like the evil power that raised it, and the companions breached it without difficulty. They untethered Melinlass and Gergi's pony, but it was not until they had gone a considerable distance that Fluda agreed to halt and rest. Even then, the bard appeared uncomfortable, and, while Gergi opened the wallet of food, Fluda sat distractedly on a hummock, meditatively fingering his ears, as though to make certain they were indeed his own.
"Rabbits," the bard murmured. "I'll never chase another."
Taran sat apart with Doli, for there was much he had to tell and much he wanted to ask. Though Doli had regained his long frown and short patience, the occasional flicker of a grin betrayed his delight at seeing the companions again. Yet, learning of Taran's quest, Doli scowled more deeply than usual.
"The Free Comets," said the dwarf. "We're on the best of terms with the Comet folk. They respect us, and we respect them. You'll not find many in Prydain to match their stout hearts and goodwill. And no man lords it over his fellows because he had the luck to be born in a king's castle instead of a farmer's hut. What matters in the Free Comets is the skill in a man's hands, not the blood in his veins. But I can tell you no more than that, for we have few dealings with them. Oh, we keep a waypost open here and there, just in case they might need our help. But it seldom happens. The Comet folk would rather count on themselves, and they do quite well at it. So we're more than pleased, for our own sake, as well as theirs, for we have burden enough keeping an eye on the rest of Prydain. As for the mirror you speak of," Doli continued, "never heard of it. There's a lake of Lunet in the Lorgadden Mountains. More than that, I can't tell you. But what have you there?"
the dwarf suddenly asked, noticing Taran's battle horn for the first time.
"Where did you get that?"
"Ilanwi gave it to me when I left Mona," Taran replied. "It was her pledge that we..." He smiled sadly. "How long ago it seems." He unslung the horn from his shoulder and handed it to Doli.
"That's fair folk craftsmanship," said the dwarf. "Can't mistake it."
To Taran's surprise, Doli squinted into one end, then the other, and raised the horn into the sunlight as though trying to peer through the mouthpiece. As Taran watched, puzzled, Doli rapped the horn sharply with his knuckles and thumped it against his knee.
"Empty," the dwarf grumbled. "All used up." "No, hold on a moment."
He pressed the bell of the horn against his ear and listened intently.
"There's one left. No more than that."
"One what?" cried Taran, more than ever perplexed at Doli's words.
"One call. What did you think?" snapped Doli.
Fluda and Gergi had come closer, drawn by Doli's odd behaviour, and the dwarf turned to them.
"This was crafted long ago, when men and fair folk lived in closer friendship, and each was glad to help the other. The horn holds a summons to us."
"I don't understand," began Taran.
"If you'd listen to me, you would,"
retorted Doli, holding back the battle horn.
"And I mean listen, hard."
He pursed his lips and whistled three long notes of a pitch and sequence strange to Taran.
"Hear that? Sound those notes on the horn. Just so, mind you, and no other way. They'll bring you the nearest fair folk who will do whatever they can if you need help. Now, do you remember the tune?"
Doli whistled the notes again. Taran nodded and unthinkingly raised the horn to his lips.
"Not now, you clot!" shouted Doli. "Keep it in your head. I told you there was only one summons. Save it. Don't waste it. Some day your life may hang on that call."
Taran stared in wonder at the horn. "Ilanwi herself knew nothing of this. You've done me a priceless favour, Doli."
"Favour?" snorted the dwarf. "No favour at all. The horn serves whoever happens to have it. In this case, you. I've done nothing but show you how to gain a little more use from something already yours. Favour? Humph. It's only common courtesy.
but guard it well. Squander it like a fool at the first whiff of danger, and you'll regret it when you really are in trouble.
Ahem, Fluda whispered to Taran. My own counsel to you is trust your wits, your sword, or your legs. Enchantment is enchantment, and if you'd been through what I've been through, you'd want no part of it.
He frowned uneasily at the battle horn and turned away.
I'll never be the same, that's sure, he muttered, nervously patting his ears. Great Belin, they still feel twice as long as before.
Chapter 11 Dorath. After eating, the companions stretched themselves on the turf and slept solidly the rest of the day and all that night. In the morning, Doli took his leave of them. Kor, at Doli's request, had already begun flying to the Fair Folk realm with tidings that all was well. From there, the crow would rejoin Taran.
I'd go with you if I could, the dwarf said to Taran. The thought of an assistant pig-keeper blundering his way through the Lorgadden Mountains makes my hair stand on end. But I dare not. Idyleg must have the jewel safely. And who's to bring it to him? Good old Doli. Humph.
It saddens me to part with you, Taran said. But you've helped me more than I could hope. The Lake of Lunet bears the same name as the Mirror, and perhaps will lead me to it.
Farewell, then, said Doli. You've kept us all from being frogs, or worse, and restored a treasure to us. You'll not regret it. We fair folk have long memories.
The dwarf clasped hands with the travellers and pulled his leather cap tighter on his head. Doli waved one last time, and Taran watched the dwarf's stumpy figure trudging steadily across a broad meadow, growing smaller in the distance until he vanished into the skirting woods, and Taran saw him no more. Through the day, the companions bore northeastward again. Taran would have been glad for Doli's guidance and keenly missed the gruff dwarf, but his spirits had never been higher. He rode eagerly, light-heartedly. The battle horn swinging from his shoulder gave him fresh courage and confidence. Ailanwy's gift is more precious even than I thought, he told Fluda. I'm grateful to Doli for telling me its power, and more than that, for telling me of the Lake of Lunet. It's a strange thing, Fluda, Taran went on, but somehow I feel closer to the end of my quest. I believe more than ever that I'll find what I'm looking for.
Eh? How's that?
Fluda answered, blinking as if he had just come awake. Though Gurgi had put all thoughts of Morda behind him, the bard seemed still shaken by his ordeal, and often lapsed into thoughtful silence when he would morosely finger his ears, as though expecting them to lengthen at any moment.
Dreadful experience, he muttered now. A flam into a rabbit. What were you saying? The quest. Yes, of course.
Smell with whiffings, interrupted Gurgi. Someone cooks tasty crunchings and munchings.
You're right, Fluda agreed, sniffing the air. Oh, blast! There goes my nose, twitching again.
Taran reined Melinlas to a walk. Lian, too, had caught the scent. Her ears forward, she licked hungrily at her whiskers.
Shall we see who it is? Asked Fluda. I wouldn't say no to a hot meal, so long as it isn't rabbit.
Taran nodded, and the companions rode cautiously through the glade. He had meant to catch a first glimpse of the strangers without himself being seen. But he had gone no more than a few paces when two roughly bearded men rose from the shadows of the bushes. Taran started. The two, evidently posted as guards, quickly drew their swords. One of the men whistled a bird call and stared sharply at their companions, but made no attempt to hinder them. In the clearing, Taran saw some dozen men sprawled around a cook fire, where collops of meat hung sizzling on a spit. Though armed heavily as warriors, the men wore neither the badge nor colours of any Cantrev lord. Some were chewing at their food, some sharpening their blades or waxing their bowstrings. Closest to the fire, stretched at his ease, a heavy-faced man leaned on one elbow and toyed with a long dagger, which he tossed and twirled, catching it first by the hilt, then by the point. He wore a horsehide jacket, whose sleeves had been ripped out. His muddy boots were thick-soled and studded with iron nails. His yellowish hair fell below his shoulders. His cold blue eyes seemed to measure the three companions with an unhurried glance.
"Welcome, lordships," he drawled as Taran dismounted. "What lucky wind blows you to the camp of Doreth?"
"I am no lord," replied Taran. "I am Taran, assistant pig-keeper."
"No lord,"
Doreth interrupted in mock surprise, a half-smile on his mouth.
"If you hadn't told me, I'd never have guessed."
"These are my comrades," Taran went on, vexed that he had let Doreth make sport of him. "Gurgi, Fluda Flam, he wanders as a bard of the harp, but in his own land he is a king."
"And Doreth is king wherever he rides,"
answered the yellow-haired man, laughing.
"Now, Lord Swineherd, will you share humble fare?"
With his dagger, he gestured toward the roasting collops.
"Eat your fill. Doreth's company never goes short of commons. Then we'll want to know more about three such as you."
"The harper rides a strange steed, Doreth,"
called a man with a badly scarred face.
"I wager my mare could stand against the beast no matter, for she's an evil-tempered brute and a killer born. Would it not be a merry watch? What say you, Doreth? Will you have the cat show us some sport?"
"Hold your tongue, Gloff,"
Doreth answered, carefully eyeing Leon.
"You're a fool, and always were."
He pulled the meat from the spit and thrust it toward the companions. Fluda, having assured himself the roast was not rabbit, ate with a good will. Gurgi, as usual, needed no urging to finish his meal, and Taran was glad to swallow his own share, washed down with a mouthful of harsh-tasting wine Doreth poured from a leather flask. The sun was dropping quickly. One of the band flung more branches on the fire. Doreth stuck his dagger into the ground before him and looked up sharply at Taran.
"And so, lord," said Doreth, "have you no traveller's tales to pass the time for my friends and me? Where do you come from? Where do you go, and why? The hill cantrevs are dangerous, unless a man knows what he's about."
Taran did not answer immediately. Doreth's tone and the look of the men around the fire made Taran guard his words. "We journey northward, through the Logadden Mountains." Doreth grinned at him.
"And where then?"
he asked.
"Or do you call my questions discourteous?"
"To the Lake of Lunet," Taran answered with some reluctance.
"I have heard of treasure in those parts,"
put in the man called Gluff.
"Is that what they seek?"
"Is it indeed?"
Doreth said to Taran.
"Treasure?"
He laughed loudly.
"Small wonder you're a miser with your words."
Taran shook his head. "If I find what I seek, it will be more to me than gold."
"So?"
Doreth bent close to him.
"But what would such a treasure be, lord? Jewels? Fine fashioned ornaments?"
"Neither," Taran answered. He hesitated, then said, "I seek my parents." Doreth was quiet a moment. The grin did not leave his face, but when he spoke again, his voice was cold.
"When Doreth asks a question, he wants a truthful answer, Lord Swineherd."
Taran flushed angrily.
"I have given you one. Say I have not, and you call me liar."
There was a sudden silence between the two. Doreth had half risen, his heavy face darkened. Taran's hand moved to the pommel of his sword. But in that instant a merry burst of music rose from Fluda's harp, and the bard called out,
"Gently, friends, hear a gay tune to settle our supper."
He leaned the beautifully curved harp against his shoulder, and as his fingers danced over the strings, the men around the fire clapped their hands and urged him on. Doreth settled back on the turf, but he glanced at the bard and spat into the fire.
"Have done, harper," Doreth said after a time. "Your tune jangles from that crooked pot. We'll take our rest. You'll stay with us, and in the morning my company will guide you to the Lake of Lunet."
Taran glanced at Fluda and caught the bard's quick frown. He rose to his feet. "We thank you for your courtesy," he said to Dorath. "But time presses, and we mean to travel during the night."
"Ah, yes, so we do,"
Fluda put in, while Gergi vigorously agreed. "As for the lake, yes, well, we wouldn't think of putting you to the trouble. It's a long journey, far beyond your cantrev."
"Prydain is my cantrev," Dorath answered. "Have you not heard of Dorath's company? We serve any who pay us to serve. A weak lord who craves a strong warband, or three wayfarers who need protection against the dangers of their journey. There are many dangers, Harper," he grimly added. "Lunet is no more than a step and a jump for my men, and I know how the land lies. Will you go safely? I ask only a little part of the treasure you seek, a small reward to your humble servants."
"We thank you," Taran said again. "It is already past nightfall, and we must find our path."
"How then?"
cried Dorath in a great show of indignation.
"Do you scorn my poor hospitality? You wound my feelings, lord. Is it beneath you to sleep beside the likes of us? Swineherd, do not insult my men. They might take it amiss."
Indeed, as Dorath spoke, an ugly grumble rose from the band, and Taran saw some of the warriors finger their swords. He stood uncertain, though well aware of the bard's discomfort. Dorath watched him closely. Two of the men had drifted quietly to the horse lines, and Taran could imagine that in the shadows they were easing their weapons from their sheaths. "So be it," Taran said, looking Dorath squarely between the eyes. "We welcome your hospitality for the night, and tomorrow we take leave of you." Dorath grinned.
"There will be time to speak of that again. Sleep well."
"Sleep well?"
muttered Fluda as they wrapped themselves in their cloaks and uneasily stretched out on the ground.
"Great Belin, I'll not sleep a wink. I never liked the hill cantrevs, and this is one reason more for liking them less."
He glanced around him. Dorath had flung himself down near the fire. Undoubtedly following his leader's orders, the man named Glof lay close by the companions.
"I know of such roaming warbands," Fluda went on in a hushed voice. "Ruffians and looters, all of them. The cantrev lord who hires their swords to fight his neighbour soon finds them at his own throat. Dorath protect us from dangers? The worst danger is Dorath himself."
"He's sure we're after treasure," Taran whispered. "It's in his mind, and he'll not believe otherwise. Lucky it is, in a way," he added ruefully. "As long as he thinks we can lead him to gold or jewels, he won't kill us out of hand."
"Perhaps so. Perhaps not," answered Fluda. "He may not cut our throats, but he might just as well decide to, shall we say, persuade us to tell him where the treasure is. And I fear he'd do considerably more than tweak our toes."
"I'm not sure," Taran replied. "If he meant to torture us, I think he'd have tried before this. He's put us in a tight corner, and we dare not let him travel with us. Still, I don't believe Dorath is all that sure of himself. We are only three against a dozen, but don't forget Lian. If it comes to a fight, Dorath has an excellent chance of killing us all. Yet I think he's shrewd enough to see it would cost him too dearly, perhaps most of his band, and himself as well. I doubt he'll risk it, unless he has to."
"I hope you're right," sighed the bard. "I'd rather not stay to find out. I'd sooner spend the night in a nest of serpents. We must get free of these villains. But how?"
Taran frowned and bit his lip. "Ilanwy's horn," he began.
"Yes, yes," whispered Gergi. "Oh, yes, magic horn of tootings and hootings. Help comes with rescuings. Sound it, wise master."
"Ilanwy's horn," Taran said slowly. "Yes, that was first in my thoughts. Must I use it now? It's a precious gift, too precious to waste. If all else fails..." He shook his head. "Before I sound it, let us try with our own strength. Sleep now," he urged. "Rest as much as you can. Before first light, Gurgi can go silently to the horse lines and cut the tethers of Aldorath's steeds, while Fluda and I try to stun the guards. Frighten the mounts, scatter them in all directions. Then...
We ride for dear life, put in Fluda.
He nodded.
Good. It's our best chance. Without blowing that horn of yours, I dare say it's our only chance. Dorath,
he added, cradling his harp fondly in his arms.
My tunes jangle indeed. My harp a crooked pot. That ruffian has neither ears nor eyes. A flam is forbearing. But when he insults my harp, Dorath goes too far. Though, alas,
Fluda admitted, I have heard the same opinion from a few others. While Gurgi and Fluda drowsed fitfully, Taran stayed wakeful and uneasy. The campfire burned to embers. He heard the heavy breathing of Dorath's men. Glof sprawled motionless, snoring atrociously. For a little time, Taran closed his eyes. Had he chosen wrongly by not sounding the battle horn? He knew painfully that three lives hung in the balance. Dolly had warned him not to squander the gift, but was the gamble too great? Should the gift be spent now, when its need was clearest? These thoughts pressed upon him, heavier than the moonless night. As the black sky began to show the first pale traces of grey, Taran silently roused Gurgi and the bard. Cautiously, they made their way to the tethered steeds. Taran's heart leapt with hope. The two guards were sleeping soundly, their swords across their knees. He turned, meaning to help Gurgi cut the lines. The dark bole of an oak tree loomed, and he clung to the safety of its shadow. A booted leg thrust out to bar Taran's way. Dorath was leaning against the tree, a dagger in his hand. Chapter 12. The Wager.
What? Are you so impatient to be gone, Lord Swineherd?
Said Dorath, an edge of mockery in his tone. The dagger twirled in his hands, and he clicked his tongue against his teeth.
Without a farewell? Without a word of thanks?
He shook his head.
This is grave discourtesy to me and to my men. Their feelings are tender. I fear you've deeply wounded them.
The men of Dorath's company had begun to stir. In a moment of panic, Taran glanced at Fluda and Gurgi. Glof had climbed to his feet and held his sword lightly, almost carelessly. Taran knew the man could bring up the blade in a flash before his own weapon left its sheath. Taran's eyes darted to the horse lines. Another of Dorath's band had drifted close by the steeds, where he stood, idly paring his nails with the point of a hunting knife. Taran gestured for the companions to make no move. Dorath straightened. His eyes were cold.
Truly, do you mean to part with us? Even warned of the dangers in the hills?
He shrugged.
Never say Dorath forces hospitality on unwilling guests. Go, if that's in your head. Seek your treasure and a speedy journey to you.
We meant you no discourtesy, Taran answered. Bear us no ill will, for we bear you none. Farewell to you and your company. Much relieved, he beckoned Gurgi and the bard and turned away. Dorath's hand gripped his shoulder.
How then? Dorath cried. Will you go your way without settling the small matter between us?
Taran halted, surprised, as Dorath went on.
Why, there is payment to be reckoned, Lord Swineherd. Will you cheat me of my fee? We are poor men, Lord, too poor to give where we do not receive.
The warriors laughed harshly. Dorath's heavy face had twisted into a leering humility, which Taran found all the more fearsome by its falsity, and the man cried out in an accusing, begging tone.
You have eaten our meat and drunk our wine. All night you slept safely under our protection. Is this worth nothing to you?
Taran stared at him in astonishment and sudden alarm. Dorath's men had come to gather near their leader. Gurgi edged closer to Taran.
Protection?
Fluda muttered under his breath.
who'll protect us from Doreth? Protection? Great Belin, I'd call it robbery.
And there is more, Lord Swineherd, Doreth quickly continued. The matter of payment for guiding you to the Lake of Lunet. It is no light journey for my company. The paths are long and harsh.
Taran faced the man squarely. You have given us food, drink, and shelter, he said, his thoughts racing to seek escape from Dorath's trap. We will pay their worth. As for your protection on our journey, we neither ask it nor want it.
My men are willing, waiting, and ready to guide you, replied Doreth. It is you who breaks the bargain.
I struck no bargain with you, Doreth, Taran answered. Doreth's eyes narrowed.
Did you not? But you will keep it, nonetheless.
The two watched each other in silence for a moment. The warriors stirred restlessly. From Doreth's expression, Taran could not judge whether the man indeed meant to risk battle. If he did, Taran realized coldly the companions had little chance to escape unharmed. At last he said, What do you want from us? Doreth grinned.
Now you speak wisely. Small scores are quickly settled. We are humble men, Lord. We ask little, far less than what our fee should be. But for the sake of the friendship between us, Doreth will be generous. What shall you give me?
His eyes went to Tyrant's belt.
You carry a fair blade, he said. It will be mine.
Taran's hand clenched on the pommel. That you shall not have, he answered quickly. I offer you bridles and harness from our gear, and even these we can ill afford. Dalban, my master, gave me this blade, the first that was truly mine and the first of my manhood. The one I love girded it on me with her own hands. No, Doreth, I will not bargain with my sword. Doreth threw back his head and laughed.
You make much ado for a piece of iron. Your sweetling girded it to your side. Your first blade. This adds no worth. It is a fair weapon, no more. I've cast away better than that. But the look of this one suits me well enough. Give it into my hand, and we are quit.
Doreth's face filled with cruel pleasure as he reached out. Sudden anger goaded Taran. Caution forgotten, he snatched the blade from its sheath and drew back a pace.
Have a care, Doreth, Taran cried. Will you take my sword? It will be a costly bargain. You may not live to claim it. Nor you to keep it, Doreth answered, undisturbed. We know each other's thoughts, swineherd. Am I fool enough to risk lives for a trinket? Are you fool enough to stop me? We can learn this easily, Doreth added. To your grief or to mine, will you try me? My company against yours?
When Taran did not answer, Doreth continued.
My trade is to spill another's blood, not waste my own. And here the matter is easily settled. Pit one of your number against one of mine. A friendly wager, swineherd. Do you dare? The stakes? Your sword.
Glof had been listening all this while. His villainous face lit up, and he struck his hands together.
Well spoken, Doreth. We'll see sport after all.
The choice is yours, swineherd, Doreth said to Taran. Who is your champion? Will that hairy brute you call comrade stand against Glof? They're both ill-favored enough to be well matched. Or the harper?
The matter is between you and me, Doreth, Taran replied, and none other.
All the better, Doreth answered. Do you take the wager, then? We two, unarmed, win or lose, and the score paid. You have Doreth's word.
Is your word as true as your claim? Taran flung back. I trust no bargain with you. Doreth shrugged.
My men will withdraw beyond the trees, where there'll be no help to me, if that's what you fear. And so will yours. What say you now? Yes or no? No, no, shouted Gurgi. Kindly master, beware!
Taran looked long at the sword. The blade was plain, the hilt and pommel unadorned, yet even Doreth had seen the craftsmanship in its making. The day Dalban had put it in his hands, shone bright in Taran's memory as the untarnished metal itself. And Ailanwy, her tart words had not hidden her blush of pride. Still, treasure it though he did, he forced himself to see the blade coldly, as indeed no more than a strip of metal. Doubt rose in his heart. Win or lose, he felt unsure whether Dorath would let the companions free without a pitched battle. He nodded curtly. So be it. Dorath signalled to his band, and Taran watched cautiously until all had made their way a good distance into the woods. At Taran's orders, Fluder and Gurgi untethered Lian and the two steeds, and reluctantly withdrew in the opposite direction. Taran flung down his cloak and dropped Ailanwy's horn beside it. Dorath waited, a crafty glint in his eyes, as Taran slowly ungirded the scabbard and thrust the sword into the ground. Taran stepped back. In the instant, Dorath sprang upon him without warning. The force of the burly warrior's charge drove the breath from Taran's lungs and nearly felled him. Dorath grappled with him, and Taran realized the man strove to seize him by the belt and hurl him to earth. Taran flung up his arms and slipped downward out of Dorath's clutches. Cursing, Dorath struck at him with a hard fist, and though Taran escaped the full weight of the blow, it glanced painfully from the side of his head. Ears ringing, Taran sought to disengage himself and regain sure footing. But Dorath pressed his attack without respite. He dared not, Taran understood, let his heavier opponent come to grips with him, for Dorath's powerful arms could snap him in two. As the warrior plunged once more against him, Taran snatched the man's forearm, and with all his strength swung Dorath head over heels to send him crashing to the ground. But Dorath was on his feet in a flash. Taran crouched to meet the warrior's new attack. For all his weight, Dorath moved quick as a cat. He dropped to one side, spun quickly, and suddenly Taran saw the man's thick fingers gouging at his eyes. As Taran struggled to escape the blinding thrust, Dorath seized him by the hair and wrenched his head backward. The warrior's fist was raised to strike. Taran, gasping at the painful shock, flailed at the man's grinning face. Dorath's hold loosened. Taran tore himself away. For an instant, Dorath seemed bewildered by the rain of blows, and Taran pressed his slight advantage, darting from one side to the other, giving Dorath no chance to gain the upper hand again. Dorath dropped suddenly to one knee and caught at Taran with an outflung arm. Striving to tear himself away, Taran felt a sharp, stinging blow to his side. He fell backward, clutching at the hurt. Dorath rose up. He gripped a short, bladed knife drawn from his boot. "Disarm!" Taran cried. "We fight weaponless! You betray me, Dorath!" The warrior looked down at him.
"Have you learned which of us is the fool, Lord Swineherd?"
Ailanwy's horn lay within Taran's grasp, and his fingers reached for it. How long, he thought hurriedly, how long before the fair folk might answer his call? Could he hope to keep Dorath at bay, or, at the last, could he do no more than turn and flee? He yearned desperately to sound the notes, but with an angry shout he cast aside the battle horn, snatched up his cloak for a shield, and plunged straight against Dorath. The warrior's knife tangled in the folds of the garment. Gaining strength from his anger, Taran ripped the blade from the hand of Dorath, who staggered under the fury of the onslaught and fell to the ground. Taran followed him, seized Dorath by the shoulders, and braced his knee against the warrior's chest.
"Cutthroat!" Taran shouted through clenched teeth. "You'd have taken my life for the sake of a bit of iron!"
Dorath's fingers scrabbled in the earth. His arms shot up. A handful of dirt and stones pelted against Taran's face.
"Find me now!" cried Dorath with a mighty heave.
Taran clapped hands to his smarting eyes. Tears streamed down his face, and he groped for the warrior who sprang away in an instant. Taran stumbled forward on hands and knees. Dorath's heavy boot drove into his ribs. Taran cried out, then fell doubled up and panting. He strove to rise, but even the strength of his anger could not bring him to his feet. He sank down, his face pressed against the ground. Dorath strode to the sword and plucked it from the turf. He turned to Taran.
"I spare your life, swineherd," he cried scornfully. "It means naught to me, and I have no wish for it. Should we meet again, it may not go as well for you."
Taran raised his head. In Dorath's eyes he saw only cold hatred that seemed to reach out to blight or shatter all it touched.
"You have won nothing," Taran whispered.
What have you gained that is worth more to you than to me?
The getting pleased me, swineherd. The taking pleases me all the more.
Dorath tossed the sword in the air, caught it again, then threw back his head and burst into raw laughter. He turned on his heel and strode into the forest. Even after his strength had come back and the pain in his side had dwindled to a dull ache, Taran sat a long while on the ground before gathering up his belongings, the torn cloak, the battle horn, the empty scabbard, and setting off to join Fluda and Gergi. Dorath had gone. There was no sign of him, but the laughter still rang in Taran's ears. Chapter 13 The Lost Lamb. Under fair skies and gentle weather, the companions travelled deeper into the hill cantrevs. Gergi had bandaged Taran's wound, and the smart of it eased more quickly than the sting of losing his sword. As for the bard, the encounter with Dorath had driven away his concern for the length of his ears. He hardly mentioned the word rabbit, and had begun to share Taran's belief in a good ending to a hard journey. Gergi still grumbled bitterly about the ruffians, and often turned to shake an angry fist in the air. Fortunately, the companions had seen no more of the band, though Gergi's furious grimaces might well have been enough to keep any marauders at a safe distance.
"Shameful robbings," muttered Gergi. "Oh, kindly master, why did you not sound helpful horn and be spared beatings and cheatings?"
"The blade meant a great deal to me," Taran answered, "but I'll find another that will serve me. As for Ailanwy's horn, once used, its power is gone beyond regaining."
"Oh, true,"
Gergi cried, blinking in amazement, as if such a thought had never entered his shaggy head.
"Oh, wisdom of kindly master, will humble Gergi's wits never grow sharper?"
"We've all wits enough to see Taran chose rightly," put in Fluda. "In his place, I'd have done the same." No, what I meant," he quickly added, glancing at the harp, "I'd have blown that horn till I was blue in the face. Ho, there! Steady, old girl!" he cried as Lian suddenly plunged ahead. "I say, what are you after now?"
At the same time, Taran heard a forlorn bleating coming from a patch of brambles. Lian was already there, crouching playfully, her tail waving in the air, and one of her paws outstretched to tug at the briars. A white lamb was caught in the thicket, and seeing the enormous cat, bleated all the louder and struggled pitifully. While Fluda, strumming his harp, drew Lian away, Taran quickly dismounted. With Gergi's help, he bent aside the brambles and picked up the terrified animal. "The poor thing strayed. From where?" Taran said. "I saw no farm nearby."
"Well, I suppose it knows its home better than we do," answered Fluda, while Gergi eyed the lost animal and delightedly patted the creature's fleecy head. "All we can do is let it go to find its own path."
"The lamb is mine," called a stern voice.
Surprised, Taran turned to see a tall, broad-shouldered man making his way with great difficulty down the rocky slope. Grey streaked his hair and beard, scars creased his wide brow, and his dark eyes watched the companions intently as he toiled over the jutting stones. Unarmed, save for a long hunting knife in his leather belt, he wore the rude garb of a herdsman. His cloak was rolled and slung over his back. His jacket was tattered at the edges, begrimed and threadbare. What Taran had first taken to be a staff or shepherd's crook, he now saw to be a roughly fashioned crutch. The man's right leg was badly lamed.
"The lamb is mine," the herdsman said again.
"Why, then it is yours to claim," Taran answered, handing the animal to him. The lamb ceased its frightened bleating and nestled comfortably against the shoulder of the herdsman, whose frown of distrust turned to surprise, as if he had fully expected to be obliged to fight for possession of the stray.
"My thanks to you," he said after a moment, then added, "I am Craddock, son of Custanin."
"Well met," Taran said, "and now farewell. Your lamb is safe, and we have far to go." Craddock, taking a firm grip on his crutch, turned to climb the slope, and had gone but little distance when Taran saw the man stumble and lose his footing. Under his burden, Craddock faltered and dropped to one knee. Taran strode quickly to him and held out his hands. "If the way to your sheepfold is as stubborn as the ones we've travelled," Taran said, "let us help you on your path."
"No need," the herdsman gruffly cried. "Do you think me so crippled I must borrow strength from others?"
When he saw that Taran still offered his hands, Craddock's expression softened.
"Forgive me," said the herdsman. "You spoke in good heart. It was I who took your words ill. I am unused to company or courtesy in these hills. You've done me one service," he went on as Taran helped him to his feet. "Now do me another. Share my hospitality."
He grinned.
"Though it will be small payment for saving my lamb."
As Fluda led the mounts and Gergi happily bore the lamb in his arms, Taran walked close by the herdsman who, after his first reluctance, was willing now to lean on Taran's shoulder as the path steepened and twisted upward before dropping into a deep vale among the hills. The farmstead Taran saw to be a tumble-down cottage, whose walls of stone, delved from the surrounding fields, had partly fallen away. Half a dozen ill-shorn sheep grazed over the sparse pasture. A rusted plough, a broken-handled mattock, and a scant number of other implements lay in an open-fronted shed. In the midst of the high summits, hemmed in closely by thorny brush and scrub, the farm stood lorn and desolate, yet clung doggedly to its patch of bare ground like a surviving warrior flinging his last, lone defiance against a pressing ring of enemies. Craddock, with a gesture almost of shyness and embarrassment, beckoned the companions to enter. Within, the cottage showed scarcely more cheer than the harsh land around it. There were signs Craddock had sought to repair his fireplace and broken hearthstone, to mend his roof and chink up the crannies in the wall, but Taran saw the herdsman's labour had gone unfinished. In a corner, a spinning wheel betokened a woman's tasks, but if this were so, her hand had ceased to guide it long since.
"Well, friend herdsman," Fluda remarked heartily,
seating himself on a wooden bench by a narrow trestle table.
"You're a bold man to dwell in these forsaken parts. Snug it is," he quickly added, "very snug, but, well, rather out of the way."
"It is mine,"
Craddock answered, and his eyes flashed with pride. Fluda's words seemed to stir him, and he bent forward, one hand gripping his crutch and the other clenched upon the table.
"I have stood against those who would have taken it from me, and if I must, so shall I do again."
"Why, indeed, I've no doubt of that," replied Fluda. "No offence, friend, but I might say I'm a little surprised anyone would fancy taking it from you in the first place."
Craddock did not answer for a time. Then he said,
"The land was fairer than you see it now. Here we lived among ourselves, untroubled and at peace, until certain lords strove to claim our holdings for themselves. But those of us who prized our freedom banded together against them. Hotly fought was the battle, and much was destroyed. Yet we turned them back."
Craddock's face was grim.
"At high cost to us. Our dead were many, and my closest friends among them. And I,"
he glanced at his crutch,
"I gained this."
"What of the others?" Taran asked.
"In time, one by one, they quit their homes," Craddock replied. "The land was no longer worth the keeping or the taking. They made their way to other cantrevs. In despair they took service as warriors, or swallowed their pride and hopes, and labored for any who would give them bed and board."
"Yet you stayed," Taran said, "in a ruined land. Why so?" Craddock lifted his head.
"To be free," he answered curtly. "To be my own man. Freedom was what I sought. I had found it here, and I had won it."
"You are luckier than I, friend herdsman," Taran answered. "I have not yet found what I seek." When Craddock glanced inquiringly at him, Taran told of his quest. The herdsman listened intently, saying no word. But as Taran spoke, a strange expression came upon Craddock's face, as though the herdsman strove against disbelief and sought to reach out beyond his own wonder. When Taran finished, Craddock seemed about to speak. But he hesitated, then set the crutch under his arm and rose abruptly, murmuring that he must see to his sheep. As he hobbled out, Gergi trotted after him to gaze with pleasure at the gentle animals. The day had grown shadowed. Taran and Fluda sat quietly at the table.